The Economy as Coloring Book.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Mark Garrison in for David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Just out this morning, weekly jobless claims, which rose slightly to 308,000, a little lower than expected. Joining us to talk about the job picture and the ongoing budget troubles in Washington is Diane Swonk. She is chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
So we have some data today and yesterday on jobs, but the much-anticipated market-moving report that would be due out tomorrow from the Labor Department is not due out tomorrow because of the government shutdown. How do you put together a picture of what employment looks like without that big, important piece?
Well, it's really extremely difficult. What the economic data provided by the government does is give us a black and white sort of outline of what the U.S. economy looks like, and the private sector data gives us sort of some color to fill in between those lines. Without the lines, we don't have a picture at all because we don't know where to put the color.
Tricky stuff. And now, as we've talked before, the jobs report is looking backward, but obviously there's a lot happening right now with the government shutdown. Looking forward, we have the debate over the debt ceiling, which needs to be raised by the middle of the month. How can all of that affect the economy?
Well, basically, the employment report for September would have just been that, for September before the shutdown. And from here on out, the fate of the U.S. economy is literally held in the hands of Washington. Whether we do well or whether or not the U.S. economy will have a tepid recovery or actually slip into recession is completely determined by what they decide in Washington. In fact, if they don't lift the debt ceiling, it could be absolutely disastrous.
Okay, Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Job stats look at the big picture, but remember that every data point in every report is a real person with bills to pay and dreams to achieve. We talk from time to time with some of these people. Today, we're looking at the special challenges facing millennials who jumped into the job market right in the middle of the economic crisis. Jeremy Fedor is 27 years old with a master's degree in history. He has a part-time job at a university archive and has done several internships in museums and archiving, but he hasn't found full-time employment. He joins us from Cleveland. Good morning, Jeremy.
How you doing?
So how has the job hunt been going? And you've kind of had a job but also are hunting at the same time. Explain that.
The hunt itself is difficult just because I've limited myself to the Cleveland area because I'm married and my family's all around here. You know, it's just not a lot in the museum and archive field, and it's a difficult field to break into.
You're 27. You have done well in terms of getting your education. You have gotten some good internships, gotten some good part-time experience. You know, you have as much experience as one could get without having a job. I mean, but is this kind of where you thought you would be in your career at this point, at this age?
No. When I was in graduate school is when the financial meltdown occurred. And I thought, well, I just started grad school. This should be fine. It should blow over. And I didn't necessarily think that it would be this difficult to find full-time work, and it's been frustrating, I think. You know, you see jobs pop up, and you apply for them. Some you'll hear back from, some you never will. I thought maybe by 27 I'd at least have something that was full-time, but unfortunately it's not the case.
What do you think that people who are older and at a different place in their career don't understand about what the experience is like for people that are just coming out of college or who have gotten out of college in the past, you know, 5 years or so?
I think there is a view that people of my age, these millennials, are a bit lazy and we expect everything to be handed to us. I didn't expect to come out with a full-time job. I knew it would be tough. I'm not expecting anything to be handed to me. And I don't think our generation is like that. I mean, I think a lot of us are very much go-getters.
Okay, Jeremy Fedor, currently working part-time at a university archive, but looking to do something full-time in the museum or the archive field using your history expertise in that. We wish you the best on that, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
This week, Marc Jacobs said he's leaving the luxury fashion house Louis Vuitton after 16 years to focus on his own company. Conrad Wilson reports on what this big move says about where high fashion is going.
Marc Jacobs' departure from Louis Vuitton marks the end of an era. at least according to fashion journalist and author Melissa McSese.
Generally, fashion is having a major return to luxury.
She says under Jacobs, Louis Vuitton became so profitable in part because it's more commercialized.
This would be the right time to sort of reposition and, as a luxury brand, really reclaim that sense of like tight, controlled, exclusive sense of luxury.
She says more and more consumers are asking for one-of-a-kind products. Marshall Cohen, chief industry analyst for the NPD Group, says there's a real danger of a brand appealing to the masses.
Look for them to inject even greater product, greater materials, greater design element to raise the upper level to make it more of an elitist product again.
Cohen says Louis Vuitton will need to find new designers to accomplish that goal. I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
And finally, the end of a delicious trademark dispute involving an iconic dessert and a fried chicken legend. Derby pie is rich, chocolatey, and nutty. It's also a registered trademark of Kentucky baker Kern's Kitchen. It recently settled a legal fight with an old restaurant started by Colonel Sanders himself. It will now stop using the name Derby Pie for its own treat. Kern's aggressively protects its Derby Pie trademark, going to court when needed. That's why many online recipes are called Kentucky Horse Race Pie, which really sounds disgusting. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.